Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts, Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters, engage today's top thinkers from around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas you can put to use in your personal and professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, Close Up Radio digs deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. Close Up Radio, where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Jim Masters.
Thanks so much for joining us, everybody. We're live worldwide on the award-winning Close Up Radio Live. This is your host, Jim Masters. Our pleasure to welcome operations researcher Richard Larson joining us here from Lexington, Massachusetts. He's been an operations researcher for over five decades. In addition, he also describes himself as an MIT lifer. In other words, besides being an alumnus of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, he's also a tenured professor at MIT. And according to Britannica, operations research is the application of scientific methods to the management and administration of organized military, governmental, commercial, and industrial processes. It's bringing the scientific method to the world in which we live, according to Richard. With a physicist mindset, Richard offers a model-based thinking approach in how you can approach and improve our daily lives. With his specialty focusing on queuing systems, Richard earned the nickname Dr. Q. Most notable of Richard's accomplishments is how he's improved the queuing system for 911 in New York City. That resulted in an improved response time of the corresponding emergency services. His knowledge and expertise have manifested itself in the most recent book, Model Thinking for Everyday Life, released in 2023. Richard explains that his book provides the vehicle to discuss what operations research is and how it applies to everyone. With operations research, lives can literally be saved. The process is straightforward to describe, really, by implementing properly and correctly everything that needs to be involved. It requires a lot of attention to detail and a lot of input from various resources. It says you need to have the boots on the ground. Now, if you'd like to find out more about the book and maybe pick up a copy, it is Model Thinking for Everyday Life. You can go to Amazon.com because the book is available there. Let's welcome Richard from Lexington, Massachusetts, to Close Up Television and Radio. Richard, welcome to the program. It's great to have you with us today.
Jim, thank you so much for inviting me. It's great to be there, to be here. Great to be here.
Great to be anywhere, right? Well, we're happy to have you here. And, you know, I like to humanize our guests and have the audience feel a connection with them. What sort of piqued your interest early on when you were considering, you know, schooling and education and career path? What was it about this kind of work, about research and operations research, that sort of tickled your fancy to where you pursued it as a career when you take a look at your own inspirational journey of life?
Well, that's a great question. That's a great question. And now having done this for decades, I've had time to lie back in my hammock once in a while and reflect on it. And basically, in high school, my favorite subject was physics. And so then when I got to MIT as an undergraduate at age 18, I'm an MIT lifer, so I started at age 18. I've never left.
Yeah.
Operations research is like the physics of the world in which we live. You know, going to the grocery store, making sure you don't run out of dog food locally. That's inventory control. And even the GPS in your car employs an operations research algorithm for giving you the minimum travel time path from where you are to where you want to go. And so operations research pervades our lives in very many ways. I call it the world's most important invisible profession.
That's incredible, and you have a real passion for it. Let's talk about some of the things that you do as an operations researcher. I sort of gave it the description as a headline in the introduction. Tell us about what an operations researcher does, and, of course, you are also MIT professor, and you're an author of that new book.
Yeah, yeah. Well, basically, operations researchers are focusing on understanding, usually modeling, sometimes putting the model on the computer, but not necessarily, and improving operations. And for instance, all the major airlines in the world are their operation in terms of flight schedules and response to delays and these sorts of things are managed by operations research people who they might not have a formal degree in operations research. Maybe they call it systems analysis, maybe they call it data analysis or whatever, but it's an operations research point of view, and that basically runs the airlines. I used to consult for American Airlines, that I got to meet some of these people, and they are amazing people. Logistics, all kinds of logistical problems are managed and operated by operations researchers. Now, operations research is really a collection of things that started way back in the 1800s and has collected together under the umbrella of operations research. My nickname is Dr. Q, if you know, Q-U-E-U-E. I love queuing because it's the only English word I know that has five vowels in a row. And that was the queuing just had its 100th birthday because A.K. Erlang, a Danish telephone engineer, invented the original mathematics of queuing back in 1920 for handle the newfound contraption called the telephone, the central switch telephone that goes from, because before that, the telephone didn't have its central switch. You'd have to drape your wire from your house to your neighbor's house, you know, and talk to them on telephone. So anyway, that was Erlang. And basically also even in World War II, operations research played a big role in anti-submarine warfare. Anti-submarine warfare is one of the major accomplishments of OR during the World War II effort. So it has a rich history, and I'm so happy to be an operations researcher because you're not in a silo when you do operations research. I'm not a silo person, so I wouldn't want to be my whole career in civil engineering or electrical engineering or computer science or mathematics. But the thing is, with operations research, it's like a bridge across all those silos. So you can bridge across the silos. And in my MIT academic career, I've had five different academic home departments that indicate that the fact that I've been walking across the bridge and having specialties here and there for several years, and then I'd move on to something else.
It's incredible. It's obvious that you've got this passion you've developed, so much so that you teach as well. Tell us about your work as an MIT professor.
Yeah, well, I'm now, I would say, 95% retired. My official title is Matsui Professor, post-tenure. So I gave my tenure slot because I only have about 1,000 of them on the entire MIT campus. That hasn't changed for decades. To somebody else, but I still have a small toe in the water there at MIT. But as an MIT professor, I would teach courses in applied probability, undergraduate courses. I would teach graduate courses in what they call stochastic processes. These are processes that evolve over time, but whose statistics whose behavior is uncertain. You have to characterize their probability. And also in the Department of Urban Studies and Planning, I taught a course called program evaluation, which was less technical.
You know, you're, as I mentioned, the author of a book, and congratulations, you know, being a published author of Model Thinking for Everyday Life. What inspired you to write the book? Tell us about the book.
Well, that's an excellent question. And basically, what was it, 2019, when the COVID hit and we had a COVID lockdown for a while, and my wife, who unfortunately passed away about a year and a half ago, but she was love of my life and my soulmate for 43 years, And I said, you know, I said, Liz, I probably, who knows how long this lockdown is going to be. Maybe I have time to write a book. And she said, that's a great idea. And so I said to her, I said, my nickname is Dr. Q. If you do a Google search on Dr. Q, my name shows up first. And maybe that's the thing I should write a book about since I know a lot about it. And she said, Nick, don't do that. You've been there, done that. You no longer have a passion for that. Think carefully for a few days what your passion is, and then write a book about that. And God bless her. That was one of the most beneficial, corrective conversations I've ever experienced in my life. And so I thought about it for a few days, and then I said to myself, the thing I have a passion for is extending the thinking of operations researchers without the mathematics, but the model-based thinking point of view to the world at large. So I said to her, I should write a book which is written for a general wide audience without a lot of math, almost no math. And so I came up with this, and the title is has the word model as an adjective for model thinking has two different meanings. Model means exemplary, thinking to be emulated, and model also means conceptual model and on occasion mathematical model. It has that deliberately double meaning in the title. And so that's what I did, and it took me 2 years to write it, and if COVID hadn't existed, the book wouldn't exist. So if I can, you know, somewhat playfully thank COVID, I thank COVID for the book.
Silver lining in everything, I guess, in life, right, sometimes?
I guess,
So operations research, you as you're describing, obviously might not be familiar with everybody's conversation during the day. What would be like a typical day for somebody who is involved in operations research? What is it that you're researching?
Well, operations research or research on operations isn't always research. Sometimes it's practice. You know, in other words, you basically let's take an airline, and so what you have. If you're the operations research person, the head person for that airline, say it's American Airlines or Delta Airlines, whatever it is, then you have a staff that works for you, and you collect data like crazy. So you have a lot of data on the load factors and the schedule, and you have multiple tasks. One is to make the schedule in the first place. And the second, much more stressful, is to respond to emergencies which occur, which are often, you know, weather-related downtimes or delays, or it could be a mechanical delay in an aircraft. And so how you manage all that, that's really an operations researcher's purview if the person's viewing operations research broadly. Now, there are some academics who view operations research narrowly, which I am not one of those, and what they like to do is they write technical papers that only can be understood by a dozen people worldwide, and they prove mathematical theorems about this and that. That's not the operations research that I'm talking about.
It's really fascinating and eye-opening on so many different levels. Do you consider yourself an efficiency expert? If not, tell us about that.
No, because efficiency expert to me is a pejorative term and very narrow. I view myself as a boots on the ground guy. For 40 years, in addition to MIT, I ran and managed a off-campus consulting firm. At one time, we had over 30 people. And on Fridays, rather than go to MIT, I'd go to the consulting firm. And when we ever hired anybody there and to go to to work on one of our projects, many of them in New York City, by the way, I said, I want you to spend day number one with 12 hours, boots on the ground, observe everything you can, and talk to everyone you can possibly meet. And don't think you understand anything about this until you have done that. And then you'll begin to get some understanding of this. And one of my favorite places that I would send people was the Fresh Kills landfill in Staten Island. I think that's capped now and closed. But at the time, it was where the other four boroughs of New York City dumped all the garbage, and they brought them over there by barge. And so we actually developed some operations research mathematical models for that whole process of the barge moving and taking from the barge to the landfill site and that sort of thing. And we published that, and that was a major contribution for New York City. And we had other contributions for New York City too, like we improved the operator scheduling of the 911 system. I think the 911 system was put in, I think it was the first three-digit emergency number in the world in 1968, 1969, something like that. It was originally just for police emergencies, but eventually it was also included a fire and ambulance. And there were some letters to the editor of the New York Times saying things like this. Oh, we called the mayor's 911 number the other night because we had an emergency. We let it ring for 28 minutes. Nobody answered. We hung up. We called again. And after 26 minutes, police emergency, may I help you? And so you start seeing these letters to the editor in the New York Times. And at the time, I had a good relationship with the police department. I said, that sounds like something that we can look at some data and maybe use some operations research queuing ideas. And so they invited me down there. I actually lived in the department almost literally for a month with two lieutenants. The lieutenants looked at the personnel training for telephone operators, and I looked at all the data. And this is actually published now as a chapter in a book. And we changed the scheduling of the operators to better match the factor of 8 or a factor of 10 change from hour to hour, day to day, and day of week of the number of 911 calls coming in. And they hadn't matched that correctly before. And it was a huge mismatch, particularly on Friday and Saturday evenings when you get the most police calls. And so we implemented that. And I remember I presented this to the chief of police. And I had the two lieutenants with me. They were there to provide support. And after about 3 minutes, the chief of police, who was a very intimidating fellow, and everyone was scared of him, said, "Excuse me, we have to stop this. Let's stop looking at these pastel kind of weird drawings you're showing, lieutenants. What really is going on here?" And because he says my advisors tell me there is no queuing problem at all in 911, and those letters to the editor to the New York Times are fake, or if he didn't use the word fake, but are bogus or whatever he used. And the two lieutenants gulped and they said, "Sir, everything that Dr. Larson is telling you is correct." And boy, all of a sudden did he look around and treat very seriously what I was saying about the queuing and the scheduling of the operators. And everything that I had recommended was implemented within 2 weeks. It was the fastest implementation of my whole career. Because I guess if you have a police commissioner who's in charge of everything and can appoint people to do things quickly, that works. Yeah,
it sure does. You have a lot of notable accomplishments, too, as an operations researcher. Tell us about some of those. And again, like we're mentioning, I mentioned in the introduction as well, improving the queuing system for 911 in New York, so incredibly important.
Yeah. I just described that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think even the book that I wrote with my colleague Amadeo Odoni, Urban Operations Research, published by Prentice Hall decades ago, that has had 1,350 citations. That was published in 1981. And it's become worldwide, it's become a classic in operations research applied to cities and operations research just more generally. So I know a lot of countries in India, and Pakistan, China, use that book. So it's not just implementation like the 911, but also organizing this whole thing and putting it together in publications like that book. Also, the paper I wrote on which models the dispatching of ambulances and police operations over the course of a city. You know, if you think about that, it gets very, very complicated because typically a half to two-thirds of the units are already busy, previously dispatched on a previous call. So when a call comes in from a particular address, let's say in Bayside, Queens, New York, the unit, the police unit that's usually assigned to that sector might be busy. Maybe the one that's in the closest sector is also busy. So you have to go outside the sector and do a cross-district dispatch. And mathematically, from a modeling point of view, that gets very complicated. I spent 2 years of my life focusing just on that model, and came up with something called the Hypercube Queuing Model for Facility Location and Redistricting and Urban Emergency Services. And now that's become a classic model to model these sorts of things, not only in this country, but elsewhere as well.
That's amazing. It really is the impact of the work. With your success in many cities, do you consider yourself sort of a urban planner of sorts?
No, I don't want to insult urban planners, but I view them as more less boots on the ground and more passive. You know, and they might write a paper about something and improve the planning by somebody reads the paper and then they implement an idea or two. Whereas I'm a boots on the ground guy, and I like action. You know, the sooner the better. If the action is supported by data and by models and by critical thinking.
Which is very important. Discuss the time at MIT. You have a real affinity and affection for it, obviously, still having that one foot in. Tell us about the importance of it, some of the courses you taught and supervised 30 doctoral students, published co-authored papers. You alluded to some of that earlier. But maybe expand on this love affair with MIT and the importance of it in your life.
Well, you know, I'll never forget. I was living in Needham, Massachusetts as a high school senior, and I got the letter from MIT, and my mother brings it out to the backyard and says, "Dick, there's a letter from MIT. I haven't opened it yet. Maybe you want to open it." And I knew it was either my acceptance or rejection. I opened it, and oh, my God, they've accepted me. You know, and which was amazing because I think they only accepted the 5% of the applicants. And my response to that was, well, tomorrow or the next day, I'll get the correction. And I told that to the director of admissions at MIT.
Like it must have been an error, right?
They said that about a third of the people who were accepted to MIT feel that way. It's the Groucho Marx syndrome. You'd never respect a club that would have you as a member.
Right. Exactly.
And, yeah, so I got in at age 18, and then they offered me a assistant professorship after I got my PhD there. And in some sense, I never left. So I'm an MIT lifer for decades. And it's been a blessing. I can't imagine a better place for me to do my work. And they really support critical thinking. They support thinking outside the box. But it's a meritocracy. So, you know, you don't play games politically and these sorts of things. And it's really it was the best possible environment for me. And working with the 30 doctoral students and then seeing them go off and have wonderful careers, also master's students and also undergraduates and teaching them and opening their eyes to the wonderful world of models and operations research. That was really a huge blessing, and I can't imagine a better career than that.
That's great. Great. That's fantastic. The book, Model Thinking for Everyday Life, again, congratulations on that as a published author, in this case with the book. Tell us about what inspired you to write it, and is there a certain reader that you have in mind, or could anybody benefit from reading the book?
You know, I wrote it, again, model here as an adjective, as a dual meaning, model meaning exemplary or to be emulated, and model meaning conceptual model and sometimes mathematical model. So the model thinking title has a deliberate double meaning. And, I wrote it thanks to that conversation with my wife, who said, Dick, you don't have a passion for cues. You've been there, done that. Do something else. And I thought about it. I said, what I really want to do is reach out to the world and have the world start thinking from this point of view, from an operations research point of view, but without the math and without the theorems and a casual conversational way, sometimes even having some humor here or there. So that's what I did. And I spent the two years of the COVID lockdown writing it. And it was a wonderful experience. So every day I start at 9 o'clock, and my brain kind of got tired between 1 and 2 in the afternoon. So I could work on it, you know, for maybe 4 or 5 hours a day, and then I would do something else.
So tell us about the actual book itself. What are some of the things you cover?
Well, we cover so many different things that we give lots of examples of model thinking, and some of them are counterintuitive. Like the best place, if you're going to cite windmills, so maybe, you know, a facility location is something operations researchers do. So you say, well, I'm going to cite windmills on these hills over here. And it turns out that the place with the highest average wind speed is not necessarily the place that will give you the most electricity. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it is.
The place with the highest average wind speed, because it turns out that the electricity from a windmill depends on the cube of the speed of the wind, not just the average of it. And so if you go to a place that the average is a little bit lower, but it gets pretty windy, you know, super windy sometimes. And so when that cube gets going, those windmills start spinning fast, you get a lot more electricity. So I love counterintuitive things like that. And in the book, I have something that a child is sitting next to his parent. And they just made a trip on an interstate from their suburb to another suburb to meet for lunch a relative, and then they drive back, and the child says to the parent, he says, look, we're coming back, we've driven 20 miles there, 20 miles back on the interstate, and the computer in the car is telling us we have 40 more miles left in the tank of gasoline than we had when we started. How can that possibly be? In other words, when you started, maybe they had 120 miles worth of gasoline, and coming on the way back, now it says 160. And to resolve that puzzle, you've got to get into how the projection estimation algorithm in the car works. And so we resolve that in the book, and I'll leave it as a teaser for the reader, for listeners who may want to buy the book and find out the resolution to this problem. And we have all kinds of paradoxes like this. You know, one of my favorites is the Will Rogers paradox. When the Okies left Oklahoma and moved to California, they raised the IQ levels in both states. And that's going to insult a lot of people, but that's called the Will Rogers paradox. And it turns out that the generalization of that gets into some pretty serious things, like in hospitals, wards of hospitals, you can actually move some selected patients from Ward A to Ward B without any medical intervention, and the life expectancy of both groups goes up. So I'll leave that as a teaser, too, for your listeners to buy the book.
Yeah. If folks want to find out about the book and maybe purchase a copy.
Systems and transportation systems, you often speed service by deliberately inserting delay. You might say, say what?
You
often speed service by deliberately inserting delay. And we explain what we mean by that. And once I explain it in two or three sentences, it becomes obvious. I understand what you're saying. So
if
the
folks
book
want
is
to get
filled with stuff like that, with counterintuitive and instructive things. So I try to make it entertaining as well as informative. So it doesn't read like it was written by an academic. I use the word academic there as the more the traditional scholar kind of writing to his or her own academic colleagues. I'm writing to the general population. And so far, the reviews of from that point of view have been pretty positive.
That's fantastic. Our special guest, operations researcher Richard Larson, joining us here. The book is Model Thinking for Everyday Life, and it's available on Amazon. Richard, thanks so much for joining us here on Close Up Radio Live. It was a real pleasure. The half hours go by in a New York minute. Hopefully we'll get a chance to chat with you again. It's always a pleasure chatting with Dr. Q. Can't wait to go around town today and tell everybody, I interviewed Dr. Q today. Dude, oh my God, is he an animated figure? Is he starring in a movie? Is he part of Star Trek? They're going to Google
this is
it.
This is a lot of fun. This is a lot of fun.
A real pleasure, and hopefully we'll chat again soon, and I hope you enjoyed the time with me as much as I have with you.
I have. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Richard. All right, you take care. Jim Masters here, thanking you for your time this time. Till next time on Close Up Radio Live. We appreciate you being with us. And come see us again. Again, the book is Model Thinking for Everyday Life. It is available on Amazon. Our special guest, operation researcher, Richard Larson. For all of us here, Jim Masters, thanking you for your time this time. Till next time. And also, stay right there. I'll be back in just a few minutes with another incredible guest featured from around the world right here on Close Up Radio Live. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.